It's Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and you're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, it's this week's edition of Food Friday, and we're playing Copycat, talking about recreating your favorite dishes from someone else's kitchen or restaurant. First, Democrats are doing pretty well in the polls for this year's midterms, but can those polls be trusted? Over the last few years, polls have overestimated Democrats and underestimated Republican votes. That was the case in 2020, infamously in 2016, and in some cases in 2018 as well. So what does that portend for 2022? It's unclear if there's actually a systemic bias in favor of Democrats or if other factors are at play here. Polling, after all, is inherently imprecise. So we're talking about polling ahead of the 2022 midterms, and we want to hear what you think at 1-800-642-1234. Do you trust those polls? Have you ever responded to an election poll, or have you ever turned away from one? You think polls are biased in favor of Democrats? 1-800-642-1234, or email us anytime, ideas@WPR.org. Samara Klar is an associate professor at the University of Arizona School of Government and Public Policy. Samara, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
So I'm curious, there is some talk that perhaps Democrats could maintain the majority in the House. They could hold on to a slim majority in the Senate. But as mentioned, the polls in recent past have seemed to overestimate Democratic support. So I'm curious how you're applying election polling data to your expectations of the midterm elections, which are now 31 days away.
Sure. I mean, it's a stressful time to be a pollster because the polls are so tight, especially in a state like Arizona, where I'm speaking to you from. And it's true. If we think about recent presidential elections, so, you know, 2020, 2016, what really hits people is the sort of surprise performance by Republicans. Now, a lot of people don't realize that the 2020 polls were actually more biased towards Democrats than were 2016. The 2016 polls weren't all that bad nationally. They actually came out very, very accurate when it came to sort of the national popular vote. However, there was a few states, and you're in one of them, where the polling really overestimated support for Democrats. In 2016, we saw a similar pattern in 2020, we saw a similar pattern, but it was actually quite a bit more dramatic. Biden was predicted to win by a lot more than he did. The reason I think people think mostly about 2016 when it comes to sort of bad polls was that although it was a very small error, it was unfortunately predicting the wrong winner. And that's what people really remember. 2020 polls predicted the correct winner, but by a lot more than he actually won by. So that's why people are a little nervous when they're thinking about, or Democrats at least, are a little nervous when they're looking towards 2022 and then 2024 as well. But, you know, if you look more sort of at a further back in history, more than just the past 4 years or 8 years, polls are not consistently in favor of Democrats. They don't typically bias towards Democrats every year over time. It swings back and forth. For example, the 2012 polls actually overestimated support for Republicans. 2012 seems like, you know, light years, you know, eons ago politically, but, you know, we're talking about a decade ago. So I don't know if we can say that polls are consistently overestimating support for Democrats. There's a little bit of variation there.
But most recently, it seems as though they've trended towards overestimating Democratic support. And what is the what's the imprecision in this? Is it sample? Is it, you talk about 2012? I think about the number of cell phones I've had since 2012. Is it technology? Is it sample? Samara, what do you think's going on in the discrepancy there?
Sure. The discrepancy seems largely attributed to what we call selection bias, which is who is actually agreeing to participate in these polls at all. And typically what we find is that for whatever reason, and we could talk about a lot of theories as to why this is, Republicans are less interested in actually responding to pollsters. So Democrats or liberal Americans are much more likely to respond to polls. And at the end of the day, a pollster is going to see who responded to the polls. They're doing their best to get as nationally representative of a sample as possible. But you can't force people to do it. It's voluntary. It's an altruistic thing. And just a quick thank you to any listener of yours who does respond to polls, because we love you. but some people don't do it. And Republicans are especially unlikely to do it. So a pollster has to take the data that they get. And what they do is they weight the data. So they try to make responses from Republicans or responses from certain types of people who are underrepresented in the poll count for more than responses from the types of people who are overrepresented. And the less representative the sample, the harder it is to do that well. So it comes down exactly to what you say, to sample, to who is actually participating in these polls.
And how are these participants in these polls being contacted these days? The old landline seems to be a thing of the past.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I always tell my students, it's not actually cell phones that killed the polls. It's call display. Call display is what, and, my college students, they were not, ever since they were born, they know about call display. The idea that when I was a kid, the phone would ring and you genuinely didn't know who it was
a mystery.
Is baffling to
right.
them. Yes. You don't know if it's your best friend, if it's your spouse, if it's a pollster, you just don't know. So call display has been an issue. It's not necessarily cell phones, because pollsters can access cell phones, as many cell phone users can attest. So these days, what pollsters are increasingly doing are relying on online samples. And these are not probability based, meaning they are recruiting people who are joining survey panels, who agree that they will take surveys as they come in via email, text message. They are advertising on social media platforms. They are sort of trying to reach people in whatever way they can. And then they are weighting their data after the fact to try to get something that appears to be more of a nationally representative sample of the population.
Samara Klar, our guest, a political scientist at the University of Arizona, and interested if you've taken a poll recently in the as we reach towards the upcoming midterm elections, 1-800-642-1234. How much faith you put in those polls when you hear them in the news, and what stock you put in them, and whether or not it changes your behavior as you go to the ballot box, 1-800-642-1234. And Samara Klar, do you think this recent history of overestimating Democrats is a sign of systemic bias?
Well, the thing that pollsters are trying to do when it comes to pre-election polling is they're trying to figure out two things. The first is, what do Americans today think about the candidates? And polls are actually really terrific at figuring that out. We're good as pollsters at measuring the public mood or measuring what people believe today. The impossible task of pre-election polling is predicting who is actually going to vote. And if you ask somebody, are you going to vote? Odds are they're going to say yes, because people want to vote. They see themselves as voters. They're planning on voting. But I can tell you there has been an election in the recent past I didn't vote for because I was traveling. I couldn't find my absentee ballot. Things happen. So that's the challenge here. Now, I don't know for sure that the polls are overestimating support in either direction. There is some reason to believe that potentially Republicans have become less likely to respond to polls because of their growing distrust in what you would call the mainstream media. And we did see that grow, of course, with Donald Trump's sort of, very regular attacks against the media. But even in the years preceding Donald Trump, there's sort of this diverging trust in the media between Republicans and Democrats. And it's leading Republicans, it seems, to be less likely to comply with academics, to comply with media. When, NBC News polling calls a Republican person, they may be less likely to want to give them their time. Completing a poll is, after all, as I said, it's an altruistic thing to do. Respondents aren't getting anything. They're not getting paid. It doesn't help them at all. They're just charitably giving up their time. And the less faith you have in media or academia or whoever it is that's contacting you, the less likely you might want to be to help them out. And I think that's had a big effect on why we're seeing Republicans as less interested in participating in polls. If that holds up, then yes, I would expect to see a little bit of over-support for Democratic candidates, as we've seen in recent years.
So, Samara, then, is it the job of the pollster then to try to figure out which Republicans are not participating in the polling and then weigh the poll in a way that would acknowledge that they exist without necessarily getting their data from them directly? And that leads to some imprecision in these polling, especially when you underscore that everybody's going to say they want to go vote, but whether it's available to them on the election day is another matter.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. So you have to look at your data and sort of stratify it by all these demographics. So, what proportion of my respondents have graduated from college? What proportion of my respondents have a graduate degree? You try to look at where they live, their income. You can ask them things like, have you voted in the past? Which I will tell you is also not an entirely accurate response. But you're trying to figure out who is in my sample relative to the types of people who typically vote. Because remember, another challenge of pre-election polling is we're not trying to match our sample to the American public. We're trying to match our sample to the voting public. And we might have great demographic statistics from the U.S. Census on the broad American public, but we have far less precise demographics about the people who actually turn out to vote. And that's the population we're trying to replicate.
We're talking with University of Arizona political scientist Samara Klar about election polling and what they get right and what they may miss. And you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Do you think polls are helpful? Are there better ways to understand what Americans are thinking about their politicians and how they plan to cast their ballot? Join us, 1-800-642-1234. Email's always available to you, ideas@WPR.org. Our conversation continues next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and right now we're picking up our conversation about 2022 midterm polling and whether it's repeating a big mistake of the recent past and overestimating Democratic support. And we want to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Our guest is Samara Klar, and she is the political scientist at University of Arizona, joining us this half hour. And Samara, you'd mentioned before that polling has been pretty good, pretty spot on when it comes to public and opinion polling, but it can be, you know, give or take when it comes to election polling. This is something that was also reiterated by a Pew Research Center, as well as the director of our Marquette Law School poll, Charles Franklin. Why is it that we get public opinion so right, but we can get elections so wrong?
Well, you know, it's a lot easier to ask people their beliefs and measure them than it is to try to predict their future behavior. So public opinion polls can tell us what people think today about an issue. And that's what polls are meant to do. Polls are not really meant to be these crystal balls that try to predict who's going to mail in their ballot, who's going to show up at the ballot booth, so on and so forth. So it's that element of predictive behavior in pre-election polling that is so challenging. Trying to measure which candidates people like today is actually quite good. And it's really important to think about polls as sort of a measure of public mood over time to see how people are feeling about candidates. Polls can help us see trends in approval of candidates or favorability ratings. But the best pre-election polling is going to be the poll that takes place as close to the election day as possible. That would be the pre-election polls that I would see as most reliable.
That makes a lot of sense. Let's go to your calls now at 1-800-642-1234. We'll start with Kay in Madison. Kay, good afternoon. You're on the air with Samara Klar.
Hi. I had took part in a poll a few weeks ago, and all the time I was answering questions, I was thinking to myself, now, is this legitimate? Is this a scam? You know, I'm more than happy to take part in a poll, but when you get so many other kind of phone calls where people are trying to ask you information,
you feel like
sell me something.
Yeah, you feel like a phone call can be a potential scam, and I feel that way too, especially if you don't know where it's coming from. And before we get Samara's reaction to Kay and Madison, let's go to Tom in Green Bay. Tom, good afternoon. You're on Central Time.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. My question is, how do we spot a push pull as soon as possible? I get some of these calls where, you know, they start out nice, but by the third or fourth question, they're pushing, you know, so-and-so, are you in favor of their liberal ideas or are you in favor of their conservative ideas?
It's a couple of calls back-to-back about the legitimacy of those pollsters once they contact the public. Samara, how can we know that what we're getting or what we're participating in is legitimate?
Yeah, these are both great questions. So push polls are technically, you know, illegal in many states. And for those of you who don't know what a push poll is sort of a fake poll that's being conducted typically by a campaign or by someone associated with a campaign, the intent of which is actually not to measure public opinion at all, but is rather to persuade. So it's almost like a commercial being delivered to you in the guise of a poll. There are a couple ways that you can quite easily figure out whether or not you are being exposed to a push poll or a real poll. First of all, push polls are far shorter than actual surveys. A push poll will typically less than a minute. It's usually four or five questions. They have no desire to actually measure your opinion. They're just trying to get an opinion across. a survey will go on, sadly, response rate a little bit, but they can last, you know, 10 minutes or so because they're actually trying to get a lot of data. So if you have a poll coming in, they're just rapid firing a couple questions at you, and the questions are containing more information than they are question, it's probably a push poll. The other thing I will say is that surveys are required to disclose at the beginning of the survey who is providing the information, who this is coming from. If you have a survey coming through and they're not telling you what organization is funding this or who this is coming from, you have every right to hang up the phone because you deserve to know at the beginning of that survey where this information is coming from. And any transparent survey researcher will provide that to you.
Samara, you mentioned before about the underreporting that Republicans have done most recently and how that has led to some overestimations of Democratic election results. And one of the reasons you gave is distrust of the mainstream media. Is there, and one of the things the mainstream media does when they report on polls is not report on the margin of error. That margin of error many times can put a poll that makes it look like one candidate's ahead into a statistical dead heat. Are we doing a disservice by not mentioning the range of error that's available in these pollings?
Oh, yes, that breaks my heart when I see that. When I see sort of, you know, Joe Smith is up ahead beating John Jones, and you look at it and it's a margin of error of 3 percentage points and Joe Smith is up by 1%. It's like, oh no. But yes, that's exactly right. You know, and the American Association of Public Opinion Research has a series of standards that pollsters are supposed to abide by in order to be considered, frankly, scientific surveys. And one of them is to always report your sample size, report your methods, report your margin of error. I think the journalists typically do a pretty good job. I like to think that journalists have quite a lot of skill in learning how to read these polls and put out correct information. But yes, sometimes you see these just terribly cringy headlines where a statistical tie is being portrayed as some sort of, you know, this guy's up or that woman's down. And you're exactly right. You want to look at the margin of error and see how much of a statistical difference is there actually between these two candidates. In the state that I'm talking to you from, Arizona, we've got a gubernatorial race where I have not seen a poll that shows any statistically significant difference between our two candidates in weeks.
Samara Clara, our guest, she is an associate professor at the University of Arizona School of Government and Public Policy, and you are invited to join us at 1-800-642-1234, where Mike in Milwaukee is standing by. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi.
Good afternoon.
I've had a problem for a long time with polls, and here it is. People do not want to vote for losers. They want to vote for winners. So when they pay attention to polls, their opinion changes based on what the polls are saying.
So you think the polls are actually influencing the results of the election here, Mike, and that there's a bandwagon effect taking place where people see the polls in the news and then get on that popular bandwagon. Is there anything to that, Samara?
Yeah, I think that Mike raises a really great question that honestly political scientists have spent quite a bit of time trying to figure out, and that's whether, you know, polls can actually lead opinion. And there are scholars that do find some effects of that. You know, typically people don't want to waste their vote. We see that. That's sort of why third-party candidates have such a tough uphill climb. So, you know, is it true that these horse race polls are guiding opinion? I think absolutely there is some of that going on. And some people question, you know, whether we should even have horse race polls at all. You know, a horse race poll is simply one that says which guy's up, which woman's down, who's where. Is that contributing to what we know about Americans' concerns about the issues that are important to them, about the policies that they support or that they oppose? No, some people argue that this is sort of an entertainment part of politics. At best, it's a distraction. At worst, it can actually guide opinion. I will say in the context of a general election, particularly in contemporary American politics, where we have two parties that are quite clearly distinct from one another, the likelihood that somebody would switch votes is small. But Mike's correct. People just might not turn out. If they see that the party they prefer is not doing well, there is a chance they might not come out at all. And you know, I think that was a risk in 2016, frankly, when we had polls saying that Hillary Clinton was 95% going to win. There's absolutely some potential that Hillary Clinton voters said, well, you know what? There's probably not much point in me turning out after all. So I think the lesson here is you should vote regardless. I mean, if you want to pay attention to the polls, you're welcome to. I do think that, you know, in it's not wrong to look to the polls for some guidance. If some people, you know, are curious to see what most voters are doing, that's fair. Some people might be actually, you know, find that to be useful information, but you should vote based on your, you know, on your values, on your preferences, and don't necessarily think you're going to waste your vote, because you never know.
And Samara Klar, what can we do to make our polling more precise?
You can respond to polls.
wait, this is on me now. I've got to do this.
It's your fault. The truth is, we all, polls are a collaborative effort on the part of all voters. And the more that we participate, the more accurate they're going to be. And I tell my undergrads this all the time. I'm like, how many of you have ever responded to a poll? And they're like, yeah, no, I've never done that. And I'm like, come on, guys, help out here. But it's true. Participating in polls is the only thing we can really do to improve their quality. And also, you know, reading them closely, following them, and understanding, you know, what those statistics mean.
Samara, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Yeah, my pleasure. Great talking with you.
Samara Klar is an associate professor at the University of Arizona School of Government and Public Policy, talking with us about polling in the 2022 midterms, which are now 31 days away. And it's a way to remind you that coming up tonight, we have the U.S. Senate candidates debate, the first with Ron Johnson, the incumbent, and Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes. It starts at 7 o'clock here tonight on the Ideas Network and online at WPR.org. Here an hour of the debate from the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association, followed by a wrap-up and analysis, and get all of it from start to finish starting at 7 tonight here on the Ideas Network and again online at WPR.org. Some people find a dish they love at a restaurant and can't stop going back again and again for it. And some home cooks decide they can't wait to get back to the restaurant and endeavor to recreate the dish in their own kitchen. That's where we are today for Food Friday. Reverse engineering someone else's recipe can be challenging, fun, or outright disastrous. Have you had this experience yourself? A favorite food item that you went home and tried to recreate? How did you fare? Let us know. 1-800-642-1234. Be honest with us. 1-800s, I'll be honest with you. 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. Our guest, James Shen, food editor at Taste of Home magazine, where he oversees the recipe selection as well as contributes to numerous books, special interest publications, and the Taste of Home Cooking School. Now, Taste of Home recently published the winners of a contest they ran at the end of last year, where they asked home cooks to submit their favorite copycat recipes, and we bring you the winners today. James, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much for having me.
And let's start with Taste of Home's interest in doing something like this, the concept of copycat recipes. Where did this idea come from?
This has been something we've been playing around with for a number of years, and it's been around for quite a long time, ever since people probably started going to restaurants, I imagine. But we've had, we've published a number of cookbooks. One of them is still on the cookbook shelves today, or newsstand shelves today, and it is selling really, really well because people want to try to capture those things at home or the things that they can't always get when they really want to. So they're trying to make those things themselves and see what they get.
So have you tried this yourself in your kitchen, James, reverse engineering a recipe, and how did you do?
I do this all the time just because it's something fun for me to do. But in fact, I was trying to recreate something that I had at Dollywood this past summer. And she was doing this. I say Dolly like she's making this. But they do a cinnamon bread that is dunked in butter and then rolled in cinnamon and sugar and then baked. And it forms this really cinnamony, crusty, caramelized. Oh, it's so good.
Sounds like
so I'm trying to recreate that at the moment.
Yeah, and how are you doing?
Not too shabby. I think I need more sugar.
More sugar, more butter. So, there a secret to what takes place in these restaurant kitchens, what they're doing back there that makes us want to try to make it in our own kitchen?
Well, I think a lot of it is what the chefs in the restaurants do is they get the best quality ingredients they can. And then they continue to do the things, same things over and over and over again. So if you're going to like an Olive Garden or someplace like that, consistency is the key because you want that same thing to taste the same as it is in Bangor, Maine, as it is in San Diego, California. So we've got to be consistent there. But the other restaurants, they're like they get the highest quality ingredients they can, and then they perfect it and they season and they taste, which is something we should be doing all the time.
So they've got a lot more opportunities to make mistakes than we do in our own kitchen. That's the way it sounds to me.
Right. The people there are, that's what they do for a living. Yeah. They sit there and they play with the food and they try it over and over and over again. Whereas we're not going to want to do that. We just want to make something, serve it to our family and move on.
So I'm getting some questions here from our Central Time team, and they want to know, once you perfect this Dollywood cinnamon bread recipe, where will we be able to find it?
Well, if I have my way, it's going to be in our next Copycat Cookbook, which I believe is coming out mid part of next year. But we'll also probably print it online as well.
Is there going to be a theme? Yeah, is there going to be a theme to this next Copycat recipe book?
Nope, we're just going with generic, general restaurant copycats. It worked for us once, and we're going to do it again because people are clamoring for more, and we just... Yeah. Anytime we put a copycat recipe up on our website, people go crazy for it, whether it's Panera, Olive Garden, amusement parks like Dollywood or Busch Gardens. They love it.
So are the restaurants themselves aware of what you're doing? Do you get their blessing in some way?
We don't get their blessing so much. So like we don't ask them. We just do it. And they're aware that we are doing it along with everybody else. There's a lot of bloggers who are trying to recreate all this stuff, too. And I think that for the most part, they're happy that we're doing this because it gives them free publicity. And then people are like, hey, I see this recipe for a fried lasagna, but let me go into the restaurant and try it there first and see if I can recreate that. And then I've never had anybody come back and say, no, you need to take that recipe down. That is ours.
Mm-hmm.
One, because you can't copyright a recipe. You can copyright the title, so we can change that. But the recipe itself, especially if we're going by it's inspired by, and we didn't actually take their recipe, and then we're all fine and dandy, and they're thrilled to death.
James Shen, food editor of Taste of Home, and you enlisted the support of your readers and your fans to bring you their copycat recipes. And give us some idea of the scope of the kind of recipes you received in this contest.
Oh, it was amazing. We received, I can't remember exactly, it was like over 700 different recipes, everything from breakfast to desserts and everything in between. So it was a little bit of a challenge to kind of dig through all this stuff and figure out what is going to be our top 12 winners. And we had a whole lot of fun testing them out, and I think we came up with some really good ones.
Yeah, and so what's the taste test like? Do you go to the restaurant and then come back to your test kitchen? And how did the process of picking these winners, which had to be next to impossible, go about?
So a lot of it, everyone that is involved in the taste testing has tasted these things before, so we know what we're going up against, and so we just tasted everything, and we're like, you know what, that's pretty darn close. And there's only a few things here and there that it's like, well, I'm not exactly sure what's missing, but it's pretty darn close, so we're going to forgive that.
Grant emailed us at ideas@WPR.org to ask the simple question, has the KFC chicken recipe ever been cracked?
If you ask KFC, they'll say no.
Inspired by KFC. How about that, James Shen?
Exactly. Inspired by the 11 herbs and spices that they use. I think that's their catch line. But I think we've got a couple of recipes that I think get you really darn close. And I believe even in this one contest, we had someone submit a recipe for KFC's coleslaw. or inspired by KFC's coleslaw, and that actually came in our first place spot, but it wasn't our grand prize winner.
Who was the grand prize winner in this contest, James Shand?
So this one is from Jolene Martinelli. She's in Fremont, New Hampshire, and she recreated Olive Garden's fried lasagna.
Yes.
So it's like they took lasagna and recrafted it, wrapped all the filling around the noodle, or wrapped the noodles around the filling, breaded it, and then deep fried it. I'm like, how good does that sound?
So here's the good news. We've got the recipe available for you, courtesy of Taste of Home and our guest James Shen, online right now at WPR.org/Food Friday. So if you were just thinking about what's for dinner tonight, how about a menu inspired by Olive Garden's fried lasagna? What's the trick to this? Is there a trick to this, or is it just a process?
It's just a process. I mean, the reader that submitted this, Jolene, did a very good job of explaining what she did and why she did things. And if you just kind of follow it along, it works really, really well. I was surprised because I'm reading this the first time and I'm like, that's going to fall apart. I mean, that's just going to kind of like mush down, and it doesn't. It works really, really well. But you just have to kind of keep things in mind, like what is the next step? And so it works well.
Well, if you don't have a deep fryer, are there other ways to go about finishing the recipe inspired by Olive Garden's fried lasagna, James?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't have a deep fryer at home either. I just take a cast iron skillet and fill it with about an inch of oil, and that works perfectly. If you don't have that, a Dutch oven, like a high-sided stock pot, Dutch oven, something like that will also work just fine.
What about an air fryer?
I think you could. I'm like, I would spray it really liberally with like cooking spray or olive oil and stuff like that. But I think an air fryer would work really well.
That is just this.
I'm going to have to give that one a shot.
Yeah, I'm very curious about all of this. I did try one of these recipes, and we'll tell you all about it. But I also want to invite you to participate with us and share your stories of trying to recreate your favorite recipes from your favorite restaurants once you make it back to your own kitchen and how you fared. Some things on social media got to just have to make you chuckle a little bit. But if you've got the story, or if you've got KFC's, inspired by KFC's chicken, we bring that as well. What have you figured out from your favorite restaurants? 1-800-642-1234 to join our conversation. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us, like Grant did, ideas@WPR.org, with your food-inspired stories. And we'll continue with our guest, James Shen from Taste of Home, next on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're picking up our Food Friday talk with James Shen, food editor of Taste of Home. And we're talking about figuring out the recipes inspired by dishes at your favorite restaurants or amusement parks or sports venues. Why not? What have you tried at home? 1-800-642-1234. And how did it go? 800-642-1234 or ideas@WPR.org. Now, the recipes we're talking about today can be found on our website at WPR.org/Food Friday. And we brought up the inspired by Olive Garden's fried lasagna recipe. But the one I tried, James, and the one that I made a lot of friends with was the recipe inspired by Humphrey Slocum's Secret Breakfast. Now, I wasn't even familiar with Humphrey Slocum.
Yeah, it is a fun little ice cream shop. They're based out in San Francisco, so I knew about them really well just because I lived there for about 12 years. But they have some really fun and unique flavors, and one of them is this, it's a secret breakfast is what they call it. But it's basically a bourbon-flavored ice cream that has caramelized cornflakes in it.
Oh, yes. Treating those cornflakes with heavy cream, sugar, and butter, and then cooking them a little bit so they're a little bit crisp, and then creating a custard ice cream that is just to die for on its own, adding a little bit of bourbon to it, and you get a taste that is just one of a kind and, you know, was pretty popular around the office.
It is. It's a really phenomenal flavor. I was floored on many aspects of it. One, the ice cream by itself, just mm-hmm. without the cornflakes, is phenomenal. It's like it's got a nice hit of bourbon, but not overpowering. It's got a really nice mouthfeel. It's very rich. But then you add in those cornflakes. And what surprised me about it is they stay crunchy.
Yes.
And I'm like, because a lot of times you throw things into ice cream and it softens up and it's really disappointing. But this one, the cornflakes stay crunchy.
Well, that's what cereal's supposed to do, isn't it? And after I gave it to one of our members at Audience Services here at Wisconsin Public Radio, she immediately went off on all the different sorts of cereals you could throw in there. You take that ice cream, and just about any sugared cereal would probably be a little something to try.
I like how she thinks.
Cinnamon Toast Crunch was what she came up with, and maybe not with the bourbon. And the other thing I'd mention is on your website, that Taste of Home website, James, there is one comment from that recipe that says, too much bourbon. I did not get that complaint once when I passed the ice cream around. Just for the record, I would stick to the recipe.
Yeah, I saw that, and I'm just like, okay, you're going to have to go back in and give a review of that one just to kind of counteract hers, because I'm like, I don't know what she's thinking about. It's like, I think it's just the perfect amount of bourbon.
I do as well, and so did everybody else that tried it, and you can find that recipe. Now, I didn't have an ice cream maker, but fortunately my sister did, and I will say, since I made this ice cream, My sister still doesn't have an ice cream maker. I have held on to that. It was just too much fun, and it was just too tasty, James Shand. And there's so many different things that you can try with it. I really, really appreciated that recipe. The one that I thought that was most daunting of your recipes, though, was the the recipe inspired by the Cheesecake Factory's Celebration Cheesecake. This is 7 layers.
This is a monster of a cake, and it's very, you look at it and you're like, oh, it's intimidating.
Yes.
It is 7 layers, and there's a lot going on. There's cake, there's ice cream, there's frosting, you name it, it's in there, and it's all covered in sprinkles. But what I love about this is the contributor, Christine, simplified it. She did a lot of things to make it a little bit easier. Like, she uses cake mix. She uses instant chocolate pudding. Freeze-dried, cheesecake filling. So there's only 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, about less than 10 ingredients in this thing for something that looks so daunting. But it is amazing, and it's a showstopper.
Yeah, and the person submitted this recipe, I think it was for her children who were born 5 years apart, but on the same day. So it would be cause for a big celebration. And when you look at this cake, the first thing I'd think is, I don't think I can make that. But then when you go down the recipe list, you think, well, 7 layers, 10 ingredients, I've got a shot.
Yeah. No, we were floored when we got it into our test kitchen, and we're like, this is going to be odd, but let's give it a shot. And it works. It works so well. And it's something that a lot of beginner cooks can even try, because you're not looking at making a cake from scratch. You're not looking at making a pudding or a custard or a cheesecake filling from scratch. Everything is pretty much done for you. So you're kind of just customizing and tweaking and assembling it yourself.
Right. You're the manufacturer of the product. Basically, and you've got all the parts and pieces right there, courtesy of the recipe that, again, is available, WPR.org/Food Fridays, courtesy of our guest, James Shen, food editor at Taste of Home. And you know, since you got the kitchen to do this and you've got the kitchen to make the mistakes, I want to know from you, James, what advice do you have for a home cook who might be interested in trying this with a dish they love at a restaurant?
So the easiest way that I like to start with is if you go to a restaurant and you try something and you're like, okay, what is it close to? And it's so if you go to Panera and you're getting their broccoli cheese soup,
mm-hmm.
the easiest thing to do is start with the broccoli cheese soup you already know works. So whether it's one of ours or somebody else's, then you're like, okay, let me try that. And then how close can I get to that? What is missing? And then it's a lot easier if you enlist other people to help you, because if your palate isn't the greatest, or you may miss something, I don't know what the flavor of tarragon tastes like, so I may not get that one ingredient right, but someone else might know. So, and then it's just a matter of just dialing it in, this herb is too strong, we don't have enough of this, the salt level's too high, it needs a little bit of acid, something like that. And it's just a matter of trial and error, doing it 2, 3, 4 times, and then you can finally dial it down into exactly what it is, or close to what the original version is.
James, did you have a favorite from the winner's list that we haven't talked about already?
The bourbon ice cream one, floored me. I love that one. But honestly, I'm a sucker for the coleslaw on the KFC
coleslaw.
I was you know what? They did a very, very good job, because I'm like, well, how big is the difference? Can that be? And I'm like, no, they did it really, really well. And then,
so what was the secret to that? What was that secret to that KFC, the recipe inspired by the KFC coleslaw?
So they did a good job of getting the texture right. There's a nice balance of sugar to acid. So they've got both sugar, lemon juice, and vinegar. So they're combining two acids. So the lemon juice and the vinegar, I think what was missing, because I was always usually using one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
But it's when they put this together, I'm like, yep, that's it right there. And then I think the other thing that I was missing out of mine is a little bit of grated onion, which is what this reader put in. And then a little bit of buttermilk is also another interesting idea that is not in a whole lot of coleslaws.
Yeah, I would not have.
A number of things that she put together and came up with a winner.
Yeah, that'll be something I'll have to try myself. And do you have a favorite submission that didn't make the winner's list, James?
Yeah, but I probably shouldn't say. I don't want to disappoint everyone.
Sorry, you didn't win this time. So as you continue to develop these recipes, one of the thoughts I had is it's just richer at the restaurant. Is that just my experience at the restaurant, or is it richer at the restaurant? Is there more butter? Is there more sugar? Is there more salt?
Yes, there is. because a lot of times people get scared when they're at their home and they're like, I know how much salt is going in here. I don't want to like make it too salty. Plus, I also know what my cardiologist is saying, so I'm going to cut back on that. Where the restaurant, they don't have that limitation. And instead, you may use milk, like 2% or whole milk in your home, but the restaurant may grab half and half and heavy cream. So it's like, yeah, they're going to go a little bit more. And but you'll also know you're going to pay a little bit more for that as well. But I also think that food tastes a little bit better when someone else is making it for you.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking too. But also, that is it richer in their kitchens? And the reason I asked this is when I tried the recipe inspired by the Humphrey Slocum secret breakfast ice cream, the thing that I found most often is I saw what was going into it and I thought, well, that is not going to be very healthy. Where I could just grab a quick pint of ice cream and not think twice about what went into it, James.
Right. But if you think about if you look at the package of ice cream, the nutritional analysis is spot on to what this one is. So it's like you're not getting any healthier by buying it.
Well, and the other thing was, I thought the cost of the ingredients was comparable to what I'd pay for at if not a little bit more than what I'd pay for a pint of commercial ice cream at the grocery store.
Yeah, I mean, if you start looking at what those higher end like craft ice creams are nowadays, you're getting into $7-$8 a pint now.
Yeah.
And I just looked this past weekend and I'm like, I'm not paying $8 for a pint of ice cream here. And this recipe will come in way under that.
Well, I was going to say, I brought my ice cream to a party this weekend. And when I was sharing it with others, I explained I thought it was maybe potentially more expensive than the ice cream at the store. And somebody said, well, the ice cream at the store has more air in it. I hadn't even thought of air in ice cream.
Well, and that's why homemade ice cream is much more richer and you get that really creamy mouthfeel. Because like that your friend said, it's like when you're commercially making this, especially the cheaper the ice cream is, the more air is inside it. And they whip it up and get the air bubbles trapped in there. And so you'll notice if you take a scoop of that and then a scoop of this particular one, the mouthfeel is going to be totally different. Even though there may have the same ingredients in there, if you've got a lot of air in there, it's just not going to taste the same.
And that's why James Shen, my sister, still does not have her ice cream maker back. Thank you. We're out of time, but thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. Oh, well, yeah, or I could get myself one and give her back her old one. Either way, I want to thank you for these recipes and remind folks that they can find them online at WPR.org/Food Friday or from our guest, James Shen, food editor at Taste of Home. James, thanks again.
Thank you very much. You have a good weekend.
You as well.